Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Network and our program, Moving Forward, on the third Sunday of each month. I'm your host, Kelly KJ Jones, brain injury survivor and now life coach. My co-host, Dr. Valentina, a clinical psychologist, is here to discuss the emotional aspects that coincide beyond our physical injuries. Moving Forward will host candid discussions with persons who have sustained a brain injury and certified clinicians who have assisted survivors. Their insight on discovery, the line between pain tolerance and pain threshold, as well as pathways to success, will provide hope and more options on how to build momentum for sustainable recovery. So I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Valentina. Wait, let's see what's going on.
I'm here.
Dr. Valentina?
I'm here.
Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday. How are you?
Good, good, good. I'm like, oh my gosh, am I a little loud? I don't know if I need to lower the volume sometimes.
No, I think it's good. The energy is excellent.
Okay, and cool, cool. And I didn't even have coffee. I'm trying to back up with coffee.
That's how I am. That's what passion and joy looks like.
What, coffee?
Or sounds like.
So, Dr. Valentina, how was your week? How have things been this week?
It was so good. It was good. I can't complain. It was a peaceful, restful week, like just good, good all around.
Wow. Wow. Yep. Well, last week was okay.
I said peaceful time with the family, you know, just good, you know.
Yeah. Turn your volume up just a little bit because I can hear you, but it's like a little bit soft. I was going to say, last week was good, but I'm super excited for Thanksgiving, for this upcoming week. And I'm also super duper excited about the person that we're going to have on our show today, Carrie L. Brooks. Carrie L. Brooks, he's going to talk to us about autism, a little bit about Carrie. Carrie L. Brooks has worked in federal law enforcement for nearly 30 years, also serving as a diplomat during this time in various countries. His most important roles, however, are those of father and husband. In 2003, the doctor told Carrie and his wife that their 3-year-old son had autism. He added, the doctor, that they should focus on having other children because there was nothing they could do for him. Finally, he said, prepare your son to live in a group home. Today, Carrie's son is enrolled in college and living his best and productive life as a young adult. Carrie and his wife allow their greatest crisis to become their greatest miracle, and now they provide life strategies and training for others to do the same to their support to support their children. Before Carrie comes on, I just wanted to say to you, did you by any chance see the news this week with the two adults in Europe that have actually uncovered the fact that they're autistic?
I heard about that. That's really interesting. How did they uncover that?
Well, they said Christy McGinnis, she is a former Miss Liverpool and a model. She uncovered it mm-hmm. through her children and working with her three mm-hmm. children that have autism. And then there's another young lady named Melanie Sykes. She's a TV presenter. And mm-hmm. she uncovered it because as a presenter or newscaster, the ear piece, she was having difficulty mm-hmm. hearing, and the feedback made her go get tested. She has a three-year-old son with autism. So I just thought it was interesting that we're seeing more adults come forth with an autism diagnosis. Are you seeing that in your practice?
Not at all. I mean, it is certain, you know, that there are people who may not have I understand that there's people who, like, didn't get a chance to get testing as a child because either the service wasn't available or their parents didn't want, you know, what they would maybe have referred to as some kind of label on their child, so they didn't get them the help. Like, I hear that a lot with, like, ADHD, for example. But, like, when it comes to autism, it just seems like it's harder to, like, sort of mask, like, you know what I mean? Even ADHD, hyperactive, impulsive type is hard to mask, or combined type. Inattentive type, because they're less, quote-unquote, disruptive to the teacher, they, you know, could sort of skirt under the radar and then eventually come in their late teens, early adulthood. But autism just seems like it's harder. I mean, maybe
who's less disruptive for the teacher? Who?
You know, a child who has, like, an ADHD inattentive type wouldn't be considered, quote-unquote, disruptive to the teacher, because they wouldn't be, you know, impulsively speaking out of turn, getting out of their seat. You know what I'm saying? That's what teachers refer to as disruptive. Oftentimes they will mislabel ADHD as an ODD, oppositional defiant disorder, because, you know, of just seeing those out-of-turn impulsive behaviors as disruptive. So like, what I'm saying is, when it comes to a child with the inattentive type of ADHD, they can sort of skirt under the radar. I can see them, because they're not, quote-unquote, a disruptive to the class, not getting that label at a younger age, because there's no necessary complaints besides, man, you're forgetful, man, you know, you're disorganized, man, you know, you're a procrastinator, you know, stuff like that. But it's not it's more of like what the parent is experiencing with a child, as opposed to some outside source like the teacher coming, you know, unceasingly, unrelenting to the parent. But when it comes to autism, I mean, I guess I can see some scenarios where if the child is high functioning, then they just see the child as maybe socially awkward, you know, gifted. And so they're like, maybe they're just mature, and that's why they prefer to play with older or younger children versus same age peers. But if it's somebody who's not, like when it comes to, like, basically what I think of when I think of more sort of like traditional cases of autism in my practice, where it's not high functioning, but it's more like the person is full on meeting the criteria, and that, you know, they are struggling socially, they're struggling, with the social communication piece even, where they miss sarcasm, where they say socially inappropriate things, don't get jokes. And then they also have these restrictive, repetitive behaviors, but they're also struggling, like, maybe cognitively on some level. That's hard to, like, go, you know, like, it's hard to see that in an adult, because they would have had so many problems in their childhood and adolescence that, you know, it just couldn't be ignored. Somebody's going to pick up on it and say something. The parent could deny services, but, you know, somebody's going to know that something is going on here, you know?
Wow.
So, yeah, I would say.
I'm sorry.
No, I just said, so, yeah, just answer your question again. Just no. Mm-mm.
Carrie, welcome. How are you?
Good evening, everyone. Happy Thanksgiving to everyone. Thank you for your invitation. It's good to be here. How are you ladies doing this evening?
Good. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Kerry, it's been a while since we spoke. I mean, the last time I spoke to you, you were launching a book, and now you are an award-winning author. Can I still call you Kerry, or do I have to say something formal?
I'm Mr. Brooks. I want to thank you for everything. You know, I really appreciate you for promoting the book, for promoting, you know, our services. I really appreciate you. So thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, Kerry, I need you to tell us all about it because I may have missed some details along the way. Usually what I do is I ask our guests to tell us about life before the diagnosis or before the, you know, the event that changed their life, the life-changing moment. So what I would love for you to do is, because what we want to do is we want to show guests some of the warning signs that they may want to look out for, and we also want to show them, you know, that there is life afterwards and the excitement and the things that can happen afterwards if you follow through and get the services that are needed. So I'm going to ask you, Kerry, if you could please share your story. You know, I want to call you Donnie McClurkin because I think you look so much like Donnie McClurkin. but I'm going to ask you if you could please share your story with us, just the beginning part, because I would love to talk, you know, through the whole thing, but just share the beginning part of like where you started to realize you before the, you know, the reason why you took your son to the doctor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, no problem. In the beginning, you know, it was just me and I was single before I met, you know, his mother and eventually became my wife. But, you know, life was good. I mean, living a single life, and I was living overseas at the time, you know, in the Mediterranean, a place called Nicosia, Cyprus. So life was good, traveling around to different countries, having a good time. And I eventually met a young lady. We got married, had a son. And everything was going well. Everything was going well up until about maybe right at 18 months, maybe, you know, 24 months.
Mm-hmm.
He was speaking maybe 20, 25 words, and he started to regress. He started to regress in his language, and he regressed to almost approximately 2 words. And during this particular time, we moved from Cyprus to Arizona. So once we got to Arizona, we started noticing, you know, he had these dark circles on his eyes. He wasn't eating. He had a lot of, you know, a temper tantrum, meltdowns. And people asked me, you know, what are these meltdowns? I basically go, they're temper tantrum on steroids because they will last anywhere from 10 minutes to 40 minutes on a frequent basis. He wasn't sleeping very well. So that was very difficult trying to be up with him most of the night and then trying to go to work. And also trying to search for resources because we're talking around late 2002, early 2003. So people
Kerry,
are talking about it, but not as much as they're talking about it today. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Kerry, I'm sorry. I just want to interrupt you for 1 second. I got
go
the
ahead.
Church finger at the same time. I'm holding it up, asking my question. I want to ask you. You know how you put the one finger up?
I know that finger.
I got the church finger up right now. Kerry, when you say tantrum, explain to me what that looks like, because some people may say, well, you know, they just don't know how to handle that child. That child needs a spanking. What is a tantrum?
And I definitely understand when people say the parents, you know, maybe bad parents, the parents don't know how to go about disciplining that child. And I get it because, you know, I've been disciplined before in the past, but when you look at the tantrum, at least with our son anyway, there's a trigger. Something caused this trigger for him. Our kids are, they like routine. So if the routine doesn't go the way they expect it should go, you're going to have a meltdown. Or it could be a smell. Our son was very sensitive to smell. He was very sensitive to sounds. So what this tantrum looked like is just all out, falling out on the floor. But it's uncontrollable. Usually a kid maybe that's not on the spectrum, if they're having a tantrum, you can come up with some technique to calm them down relatively quickly. With our son, it took a minute for us to discover what would actually calm him down. And a lot of time as well, we had him in it. We had his own room. We would go in there, and the room would just be totally in disarray. Covers off the bed, books off the shelves. So we just started taking things away. And this is not like a kid just trying to be bad. These are impulses that he was having that were just totally uncontrollable. This is not about discipline.
Now, was he attacking? Would he attack you, or was it himself? Like, was he injurious in this process?
No, not at all. Not to neither one of his parents nor to himself, but to certain items. Like I said, things flying off the shelf, covers flying off the bed, on the floor, just kicking and screaming. You'd be afraid that he's gonna accidentally hit his head or hit one of his limbs on something and hurt himself, because it's totally uncontrollable. But he wasn't intentionally trying to hurt himself.
Mm-hmm. And he wasn't trying to hurt anybody else in the room.
Right.
Correct. Correct. That is correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something. I'm so glad we're talking about this, because it's so interesting. Like, he's given us some really nice nuggets symptom-wise to pay attention to, and he's differentiating the fact that there's overlap in symptoms with this, you know, like a sort of disruptive behavior disorder, as far as just the look of it, the one symptom tantrum, but then, you know, with what he's describing in autism. And that's why they're like, sometimes it's like, well, what does the child have? Like, what's going on? Actually, I also heard some sensory processing concerns, right? Like he was overstimulated by smell. There's also, you know, when you think of the five senses, there's sound, you know, sirens sometimes could be an issue, or fireworks, you know, all types of, yeah. And the same with like taste, you know, and texture. There's touch as well. Some like seek it and some like avoid it. And then there is, what is the other one? Did we say smell? There you go. So yeah, this is excellent. Sometimes people come to me for an autism evaluation and come to find out socially there's no struggle. It's more sensory-wise. And so because they show overlap in some of the symptoms, parents automatically think it's autism, you know, but it's not. But so please continue sharing your story, because I think this is really helpful to listen to hear the difference.
Well, one of the things, like I was saying earlier, and you're absolutely right, with the sound, in one particular situation, he was walking with his mom to like a strip mall, so walking on the outside, and a loud motorcycle went by. And we had never noted this before, and he just took off running through the parking lot, and she literally had to chase him down. And this was the first time that this happened to, you know, with us, and we were unaware. But it's like, if they're sensitive to sound, definitely hold their hands, because of a motorcycle or any siren go by, there's a potential that they may react to a situation where they just take off running and possibly, you know, get injured.
Safety concern. Mm-hmm.
49%, almost 50% of people with autism elope. That means they will flee from a safe environment, you know, run across highways, run, you know, you keep hearing about these children with autism getting lost in the woods and that kind of stuff. And when there is that overstimuli, when there is a crowd of people, when there's loud noises, things that they're not used to, I know that some kids are disturbed by glasses, you know, if somebody has on the glasses, or, you know, like I said, like you said, the perfumes or anything like that. You never know. You never know what's going to bring back a memory or bring back a time, you know, bring back a something that's going to be less productive in a social environment. You know, you can't have too many people around.
Just to make it even more relevant, like for the speakers, the listeners, as far as like situations where a child or a person may elope, and I'm gonna say a child or teen, because especially if they've been getting interventions in their child or adolescent years, there's a lot of hope that in their adulthood they would then learn, you know, ways to manage and cope, even if it's using headphones, you know, sound blockers. But as far as the relevancy, like what's probably more common, especially if somebody is in Chicago like me and they don't have access to woods, a child could elope from a school. Like, their safety concerns that show up in school settings where a child will run away because of the fire alarm, because of the bell just from, moving between classrooms, like anything, So yes, they may run out the actual building.
And to add on to that, one thing I encourage parents to do is to make note of what some of the triggers are for their children that may cause, some type of anxiety, some type of incident that will cause them to wander away. But to share that with the school, to the caregivers, and also to see where did our child eventually end up. Because you can keep notes, and maybe this is the first place you want to look if it happens again. So these are the things that we talk to the parents about as well.
Exactly, and it gives you some insight into what their sort of safe place is in the school, and why it's that place. Maybe it's something similar as far as the home, like a space that's quiet, that perhaps is, I don't know, maybe dark, or even that's tight on some level, like a closet or something. I don't know, like less stimulation. That's an excellent point, and it's. And I want to point out, too, you just noted another disorder or, symptom that could sort of cross, present itself between two different disorders, and that's anxiety, right? So we talked about some of the tantrums, which is also present in disruptive behavior disorders like oppositional defiant disorder. We talked about what triggers the basically tantrums and how they are different from a child with ODD when it comes to autism, and that would be an anxiety-related issue that could come about because of a sensory processing issue. So I'm just going to keep doing it for our listeners, because there's some people who went through what you went through, but there's other people who are kind of in it right now and have no idea, like, what they're looking at,
Dr. Valentina, do you deal with the somatosensory?
You said what? Do I deal with what?
Somatosensory responses.
So when I think of sensory-related issues and how they show up, which is really in a somatic physical form, like the child, like they elope or they strip down before they even use the toilet, I would say yes. But I got a feeling you're talking about something a little different. So let me make sure I understand what you're saying.
I mean like something may touch their arm, but they feel it in there. It brings back a sensation that where somebody kicked their leg, or do you know what I mean? Like,
I haven't experienced that. I've heard of that, but no, that's real interesting. I wonder if that's more medical, and that's why I don't know.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I was just gonna say that certain sensory input or environmental input that we would think would happen, we might think that it impacts their ears because the sound is loud, but it might actually impact like what they see, because what they what they hear brings back recall of something that they saw. So people might try to treat what they're hearing, but before you can really address, or people might address what they're seeing because it seems like it's what they see, but it's really not what they're seeing that's causing the challenge. It's actually what they heard.
That makes sense.
So sometimes because of the complexity or the way that individuals are wired, you might see one thing that is actually another thing. But Carrie, look, I am not talking anymore. I won most talk. I'm not saying anything else. Please tell your story, because you're the one that won the book, not me. I mean, won the award.
No. So that's what we were when we first got into, our greatest crisis. That's how some of the things that we noticed that we started seeing in the beginning. And then eventually, as we continue to notice those signs, those symptoms, we, take them to a general practitioner. Then we were referred to a psychologist. And then we had some tests ran, and they came back and informed us, that our son, was on the spectrum. We went to get a second opinion, and this doctor was like, "You definitely have autism." And this is the doctor that told us, "There's nothing that you can do." Our son was very young, very young. There's nothing that you can do. Focus on having other children. Focus, you know, get ready to, you know, have your son in a group home. And my thing at that particular time was, you know, I understand that in some cases this is reality, but my thing is give me an opportunity to try my very best. And once I try, if that's what it is, that's what it is. But give me something to go on that I can help my son because he is so young. What can we do? And that particular doctor just didn't have any strategies for us.
It's almost like that the doc projected his or her own ignorance onto you, which is, I guess, what anybody would do, especially in that role. But that's so messed up. Instead of, like, wow. I think it helped, as far as I go, to have a spiritual background where I'm like, you know, I understand I don't know at all, and that words are powerful. Like that's so messed up. And this is why I'm so glad that you're on the show, because you're going to provide hope to challenge what a doc said and not accept sort of, because I could even see this on a medical physical end where there's like a death sentence. If, you know what I'm saying? It's like there's no hope for you. It's like that's enough to make a person give up. Like, that's crazy.
It is.
You know, this is helping listeners, you know.
Sherry, how many tests did it take for them to give you that ruling? Like, what kind of tests were involved?
The first test went to, because at this time, we're talking almost 17 years ago, and the first test came out, the psychologist took him in the room by himself, and since he was being, actually we had to go back because he was being disruptive, so I can't remember exactly the test that he went through on because of the length of time that it's been, but we did have to go back for a second day because she was unable to test him because he was just being totally uncooperative.
Yeah, because he probably like, who is this stranger? See, they talk about autism, social skills. How about just he recognized stranger danger? I don't want to go on a road with you by myself, woman. You know, I mean, come on.
Looking back, you're looking back. You're probably absolutely right.
Yeah, you're like, who is this?
Once we did receive the diagnosis, we asked for help on getting, where could we start? What could we do? And basically, we just started piecing things together ourselves, finding resources. And at that particular time, Arizona was pretty good in helping us finding resources, ones that were available. There were many at that time that weren't available. That's available today. So we just started looking for a support group. We started looking for different conferences that we could attend. We started researching books that we could read. We started educating ourselves on what we could do to help our son reach his full potential.
That's a big deal. And that's what separates you all from, I'm not going to say most people or a lot of people, because I really don't know. I think it's cliche to say something like that. But I will say from some people who rely too much on the medical industry, you know what I'm saying? That's why they're sort of damned by their sort of trust or faith in man. You know, what you all did was you said, I would not accept that. I would at least like know it for certain through my experience and efforts in trying different interventions. And so let me research, let me see what's out there, you know? I mean, it's just like, wow, this is amazing. All I could do is think of, like, what your parents instilled in you all, you know, and how you attracted each other and was able to make each other better, and consequently your child. And I'm assuming, I mean, from your website, you know, multiple families, you know, since then. And by the way, I just looked up the ADOS, which is the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule. It's on its second edition. This is like what I would administer. It's gold standard autism testing, and that's what you do with the child alone. It's play-based testing for about 45 to 60 minutes. And then there's also the hour-long interview with the parent. And the child, you could do it with the child alone, but the parent could be in the space if the child needs them to be in it, especially at that age. Parents should be there. But it's been around since 89, and so it's likely that's what the doc used.
Are you able to break this up, or does the child have to sit there for 45 minutes? Can you do 15, 15, and 15?
No. It's definitely, you know, like all the way through. But It's not, the child is not sitting there. It's play-based. So there's some stuff where the child is at a desk looking at a picture, but the child don't have to be seated. He or she could be standing. And then there's also stuff that could occur on the flow. And, you know, so it's play-based. It's not like classroom-type stuff. I mean, if, for example, like one of the things that you do besides looking at a picture and kind of talking about the picture and kind of trying to have a dialogue to see how the child responds to, if you say, oh, you know, I have a cat, and then you're hoping that the child would say something similar, or even like if the child's using gestures, right, like pointing, things like that, you know, at the picture, look at this, or if we even say like the child's name, you know, our hope is that the child's going to turn and respond to their name, you know, at least by the third time. I think after three times we won't then continue on. So, you know, it's just a lot of play-based stuff that doesn't require sitting, it's, you know, at a chair like a traditional cognitive test or something.
So, Carrie, I'm guessing that when your son took those tests, there were certain gaps along the way. And then you and your wife began to read. What would you say was like your immediate goal and your long-term goal based on what you were reading? So you were reading that saying like, if we could just get him to do this, but we ultimately wanted him to do this. What were you thinking?
I think the most important thing, even looking back and reflecting on it, when I do have an opportunity to work with other parents, because once you're in it, you know, you're going through a crisis. You just want your kid to be quote unquote typical like everybody else. And I just don't know if that's the best approach. So our thing was, you know, once we overcame some of our own anxiety, our thing was how can we go about helping our son to be happy and mentally well? Because one thing that I noticed along the way that if he's happy, if he's mentally well, he's going to learn how to read. He's going to learn how to write. He's going to learn math. So our thing wasn't so much academically inclined. It's like, let's make sure that his well-being is taken care of, and he will learn as he go. So it may take him 6 months, a year later, you know, to catch up with his peers, maybe longer than that. But as long as he's happy and was making progress, we were good to go with that.
And think about it. Think about it. Mm-hmm. When you're happy, you learn better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you're in an environment where you feel it's conducive. Right. So why would you think any differently of them? Mm-hmm. So I love that. So your focus. So you're saying your focus became creating the environment?
Oh, absolutely, because at that time we're talking he's three, going on three and a half, so he's not in preschool, he wasn't in kindergarten, so most of his time right now was being spent at home. So we had to create this environment for him and prepare him for daycare, preschool, and eventually kindergarten. It's like, you know, to be able to follow one-step rules, two-step rules in school, so they would allow him to attend. So we did many things at home, did a lot of role-playing at home. We did a lot of role playing when it came to school. We did role playing before we took him to the playground. How do you make friends? How do you say your name? We just did a lot of role playing with different scenarios that he would encounter.
Wow.
What about laughter? What about laughter during this?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the main ingredients. Even at home, what we would do, we would turn on music and just start dancing to get him to start moving, just to get his energy up, and to also for him to just be relaxed and be in a space that he knows he's safe and that he is secure. So laughter is huge. And like I said, during story time, what we would do is not just read a book to him and just hopefully that he will learn the words. But what I would do is to bring this book to life. You know, one time he was into dragons, so we were reading a book about dragons. So we were going to go out and capture a dragon. And so what I did, I put a cape on him. I gave him a fake sword. I was his horse. He got on my back. And we trotted through the house looking for a dragon. And I said, we spotted one. Let's go get this dragon. And my thing was, you know, being from my generation, let's go and kill this dragon. And once we got to this dragon, he said, let's tickle the dragon and make him our friend. Yeah. And to me, that just blew my mind away that someone that young would say, let's tickle the dragon and make him our friend. You know?
And it's social. And it's super social. Look at that. Like, how, first of all, it's genius and creative. So I'm thinking cognitively, wow, that's impressive. You know, and then it's social. It is social, okay? Because he's thinking of a genius tactic to get this dragon who's fear, you know, full of, you know, fear inducing, you know, to be like that, oh wow, that, I mean, that right there would have told me, okay, huge milestone. Like I'm not even worried, because look at what he's showing, look at how he's improving based on what we're doing, you know, as his parent. So that's excellent. That's excellent.
And we just kept going. We just kept going with it throughout most of childhood.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
So, Cherry, speaking of humor and laughter and, like, you know, all that other kind of stuff, Dr. V, I want to see if I can share something with you real quick.
Yeah.
And the listeners, hold on 1 second, because we're going to learn about all the talents of Mr. Some more talents of Mr. Brooks. You ready?
Yes.
Autism. Autism is one of a group of disorders known as autism spectrum disorders, ASD.
Be the first to respond autism to awesome. Be the first to respond autism to awesome.
911, what's your emergency? It's urgency. My child been diagnosed with ASD. How could this be? Why did it happen to me? God, I know that you care. Autism is a really big scare. So I sat and wrote you a letter, begging you to make my child feel better. Then I laid down and cried, asking you why, oh why. This battle raging through the night, will we ever win the fight? Please help me to see, let's find a cure to ASD. Sometimes feel I'm not gonna make it, don't really know if I can take it.
Be the first to respond autism to awesome. Be the first to respond autism to awesome.
Wait, look, here it comes. I see the light from the morning sun. I understand, I have a plan. First come together and join hands. Father, mother, sister, and brother, love our children like no other. Grandparents, lend a hand. Help out. Children, knowledge expand. Teachers, use your teaching techniques. Teach these kids who are unique. Even as friends, you can help our children win. Every now and then, my neighbor can even do me a favor. People ask, where are the dads?
We're here,
and we're hurting bad.
Be the first to respond autism to awesome. Be the first to respond autism to awesome.
Oprah, thank you for spreading the word. This autism mess must be heard. Holly Robinson B, the things you're doing are really neat. Tyler Perry just wants you to know we should do an autism show. Just like Jenny B, in it to win it. Let's educate before we meditate. I sing this song for my baby boy. You know you are daddy's joy. I sing this song for my baby girl. You know you are daddy's world.
Daddy, step back. Let me do my thing. Pass the mic so I can sing. Be the first to respond autism to awesome. That's right.
Be the first to respond autism to awesome.
That's right.
Be the first to respond autism to awesome.
That's right.
Be the first to respond autism to awesome.
That's right.
Be the first to respond autism to awesome.
That's right.
Be the first to respond autism to awesome.
Okay, guys, you see why I didn't cut it off? That was awesome. So first of all, I heard two challenges in there. So one was obvious and one was a little less obvious. So one was Tyler Perry, come with it, because Perry Brooks is ready. It is deluxe. Are you up for the challenge, Tyler? Don't talk about all it and then not come through. Come on now, Tyler. And all these people are listening that know Tyler, look it up. Then number two, was, I think you out there challenging Donnie McClurkin, trying to get that Stella or that Grammy or something. I heard a little Donnie out there. Donnie, get nervous. You're looking like it's coming after you.
I don't think he have anything to worry about. He doesn't have anything to worry about. Oh, my goodness.
You won't be on the stage again. I thought that was so awesome. And when you talk about the laughter and the animation and being in the moment and enjoying the moment and making memories, I think sometimes people get overwhelmed with what's going on around them, and they forget. Mm-hmm. They forget that every moment is precious. Precious. The moment mm-hmm. you have today, right here, right now, is gone. Mm-hmm. I mean, right after this second, it's gone. So you have to make the most of every single second, and they feel it. You know?
Yeah.
Because the more intuitive,
absolutely.
They feel it from their parents. I was reading something recently. I love to read these little articles. And it was saying that kids don't want their parents to be perfect. They want their parents to be happy.
Mm.
That's powerful.
Mm-hmm.
That's powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Mom, Dad, yep. I'm not looking for you to be perfect. I'm looking mm-hmm. for you to be happy, because if you're happy, then I don't have to worry.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Wow.
So as you're moving forward, Carrie, what would you say was the first sign of success, or the first sign of breakthrough, or the first sign that was beyond the prognosis, or what was that first thing that you saw that you were like, we got this?
Mm-hmm. I would say it was at one of his birthday party. It may have been birthday number 8. And we mm-hmm. had, and you know, he didn't have a lot of friends. I think maybe 2 or 3 kids showed up, you know, that we knew as parents. But we invited mm-hmm. 2 of his teachers and 1 of his aide from the school, and they came mm-hmm. out to the party. And we had, you know, we had a bouncer, we had different type of food, and he was so happy that day. Just like mm-hmm. after the party was over, we were in the park. He was just laying on the ground, just looking up at the sky like, this was the best day of my life. It was just like, you know what? He's experiencing. We talk about him having joy, trying to make him happy, but I can see the glow in his face. I can see the expression. I can see the gleam in his eyes that he's experiencing joy. And it's like, how do we hold on to that moment and have more of these moments that he's experiencing joy? Because with him experiencing mm-hmm. it, he's going to want to go on to do other things to keep that feeling going. So that's when I said that we really like, wow, maybe we're doing a few of these things right. Let's continue to find out what mm-hmm. works. We'll throw out the stuff that doesn't work. But that was one of those aha moments for us.
Yes. And that makes me just like, right, is this, like, at some point where you're like, okay, we need to start helping other people. Like, did you start along the way recording some of the successes and interventions or strategies you was using that was working?
In the beginning, you know, my wife, she kept a journal of every day, because she stayed home. Did the heavy lifting. I would come home. She'd say, "Read this book. Read this portion. Read this journal. This is where he is." So, because you have to, hopefully, you can be on the same page of where's our child progressing, where are they? So the other parents mm-hmm. can jump in. The grandparents can jump in. So that's mm-hmm. how we just started trying to help ourselves. And along the way, we started mm-hmm. noticing that mothers were the foot soldiers going to the conferences. Mm-hmm. You know, leading the support groups, and she said, "Why don't you just, you know, do something for fathers?" I'm like, "You think so?" And so when I started talking to other mothers, they go, "Can you talk to my husband?" So I started out doing something for fathers, and eventually he and I recorded a song called "Fathers Do Matter." So that I started doing something for fathers, and then it just progressed on to helping everyone who had a child, you know, that needed help, and that's our goal. Can we help somebody else by sharing our story?
Right. Wow. So we all through the groups and people being like, "Oh, this is great. Talk to my dad." Wow. That's excellent. I'm glad you stepped up, because look at the blessing that came out of you know, you sort of being obedient to sharing your gift with that, you know.
And the conference that you host too, the conference that you host and the webinars and the seminars, that that's very powerful. I mean, I'm hearing that more and more, where dads have, you know, they have hopes and dreams for their sons. They have expectations that they're going to be doing this, this, this. And then when they don't, it's a challenge. And so I do, I'm not going to play the whole thing, but I do want to play a little bit of Fathers Do Matter. And the reason why I want to share this, Carrie, is you are such a blessing, because once again, like I said, some people view the diagnosis as the end instead of the opportunity. And I want to make sure that there isn't shame in seeking, you know, seeking the, you know, I don't want to say the diagnosis, but, you know, seeking the insight, the additional insight and the support when things look different. And I just love the light that you're bringing to it. So I'm just going to play a little bit of Fathers Do Matter, because fathers do matter. Hold on a second. That's kind of cool.
No, I'm not. He's touching me. No, I'm not.
Don't stop there before I tell your father when he gets home.
Fathers do matter. Yes, they do. Say fathers do matter. Yes, they do. Fathers do matter. Yes, they do. And you know it's true. Fathers do matter. Yes, they do. Say fathers do matter. Yes, they do. Fathers do matter. Yes, they do. And you know it's true. Please allow me some time to drop this rhyme. One or two things that's on my mind. Here's what research shows. Boys and girls need their fathers to grow. See, I wish I had a good old dad. The one I talked to when I was sad. Tuck me in the bed and read me a story. Sorry, lovely, saying he loved me. Then he hugged me. I would be amazed knowing God gave me the best daddy ever gave. Fathers do matter. Fathers do matter. Yes, they do. Say, fathers do matter. Yes, they do. Fathers do matter. Yes, they do. And you know it's true. Fathers do matter. Yes, they do. Say, fathers do matter. Yes, they do. Fathers do
matter. Carrie.
Yes, ma'am. Yes,
ma'am. What is a common theme that you're seeing with Fathers Do Matter? Like, from the time that you started to where you are now, what are some of the inroads that you've made, and what are some of the impasses with fathers of children with autism?
I think from when we first started, fathers were definitely reluctant to be involved. Like you said, fathers, like mothers, we have hopes and we have dreams for our kids. But what I saw along the way, that mothers was definitely the foot soldier. They would share their emotion, their feelings with other women. They started support groups. So they would get everything out there and talk about, and they had support. And there was no shame. But for men, it was this thing of retreating to our cave, because our son maybe wasn't going to be the star quarterback, wasn't going to be, you know, the best baseball player. And it's like, folks, there's so much more to life. So now what I see is, and we have done these webinars where we have fathers on there, fathers are being involved. They're doing physical fitness. They're doing whatever it takes, you know, to support their children. My whole thing is to keep it going, and just by telling my story, other fathers sharing their story, the other father will go, okay. You know, it's not the bad. We're not the only one going through this, so you're not isolated. You're not the only one. It's not that bad. And there are things that you can do. There are little silly things that fathers can do that help relieve the stress at home with, you know, the mother, or also and also with the child as well, by giving the mother a break as well. You know, take the son to the park. Let him climb the bars. Let him climb the ropes at the park. Just being involved and having that bond is going to do so much for the child in the short term and in the long term.
How important was physical exercise for your because your son played sports, right?
Correct.
What sports did he play?
He played basketball and he played volleyball.
And how did you introduce him to those two? Like, how important were sports to him as far as organizing and focusing and whatever, social, whatever it may be?
Listen, that's my foundation. sports is my foundation. I played sports all throughout my life, college, high school. And so as we – and my thing was, how can I get him, number one, to socialize? Because he was a loner, wasn't making friends. How can I get him around a group of young boys where he can have opportunities to see some of the appropriate behavior that other young boys are doing, and maybe, you know, they can be not even realizing a mentor to him, and he can just learn from them. And also, by him being in sports, we started with basketball. And what I noticed was that, you know, we got this, we're obsessed with this winning. And I get it. I love to win, but I wanted my son to learn. I want him to love the game of basketball. So I became his coach the following year. And my whole thing is, I want you to learn from sports, because to me, it is a classroom. It is a life lesson from sports, because there are ups and downs in sports. Sometimes you lose, sometimes you win. I had a child one day, we were playing basketball. He fell down and he looked at me. I said, get up, son. You didn't invent falling down. Get up, play basketball. So my whole thing is, if we can teach these kids through sports, you know, when you get knocked down, to get back up and keep going. So those are the things that he took from sports. And also by focusing on dribbling, passing, you know, these are the things that can that translate into the classroom as well, by being disciplined and paying attention. And these are the things that we tried to instill upon him and that we saw that helped him to be, you know, do very well academically in school also. So sports is my education. Even if I talk about balling for autism, I think the ball, in my opinion, is the world's greatest invention.
I agree. We talked about this. It wasn't, maybe it was the last show, but we definitely talked about this. We had a guest on who, as you know, who has a diagnosis of autism, and he went through a lot. You know, he's telling his story as a child and what he, you know, how he's basically been an advocate, you know, for the community as an adult. And it just reminded me of some of the research in preparation for that show, you know, that of what you're saying now, like exercise is real. Like it actually improves, like you know, your attention, because you know that there's also a lot of overlap and inattention, you know, when with children and autism or individuals with autism, because part they're overstimulated because the sensory, so it can impact their ability to focus. But also, you know, like when I think about the repetitive, restricted, you know, interests and behaviors, exercise, physical activity, like it lowers those sort of those acts that are repetitive, the stimming, you know, the flapping.
Absolutely.
So it's pretty cool that y'all, like, you know, you channel that. And then we know just in general, exercise is a natural antidepressant, you know, for the psychotropic drugs. Like, you can do something. There's natural, you know, options. So that's, like, really, really, really super, super cool. I want to make sure I don't forget to ask. I was looking at your site, autism2awesome.com. So autism2awesome.com, and I'm looking at your partners, and I was impressed with who the partners are, but then I also wondered, like, about Autism Speaks, you know, did they reach out to you, or you reach out to them, or I guess how did the partnerships happen, and so that I can make sense of why they aren't on here?
Well, some of the organization reached out to me, and the other time I reached out to them. These are the ones on the website that we have worked with in the past. And then Autism Speak just, you know, happening not to be one at this particular time. So we just move forward with the ones we invite to speak.
Yeah, and I'm noticing a pattern as far as Phoenix, Arizona, and I'm also seeing, like, City of Phoenix, first responders, blacks in government. So it's like I think you're tied to, you know, Austin and law enforcement is also showing up, which is excellent, because I'm assuming you feel somewhat supported, you know.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, being on this show, this is Kelly and I's second time, you know, connecting with one another. So along the way, whether you're getting your services out there, your book or whatever, or, you know, you're learning about whatever crisis that you're going through, you're not alone. People are willing to help. But that's why I think when I talk about the women being able to talk to their, you know, talk to other, you know, female friends. They're getting the word out, and they understand what they're going through, and they're willing to help. As fathers, I want to see us do that more, to let one another know what's going on, because we can't help if we don't know what's going on. So that's and we didn't do anything on our own. I'm not here because of myself. I'm here because other people lifted me up, other people prayed for me, other people encouraged me. So I'm not here alone. So many people have helped our entire family along the way, and I'm grateful and I'm thankful every day that God brought these people into our life.
Every successful case with persons with autism, with kids with autism, if you listen to what they're saying, they will tell you that it was a community that helped them. I mean, it may be a mom or a dad that they highlight, but when they start to list the organizations and the communal support, and excuse me, when I say communal support, I don't mean one organization, you know, this organization. I mean, excuse me, they're listing 5, 6, 7, 8 organizations that helped them along the way to get to where they are. Carrie, one of the things that I thought was interesting is when you start talking about, when I was reading that you're working with the police force and police training, et cetera, and I also know about your military ties, that you are working with the bravado of bravado of bravado of men, talking about a situation or a subject that is probably, you know, the polarization of kind of like the bravado image. So with your ability to be able to talk to, you know, officers who have that tougher exterior, et cetera, what have you found them to say is most enlightening or surprising? Like, as you're helping dads and parents, because the thing is, I don't know all the questions out there. You know all the questions out there. So what I'm trying to say is whatever are the most critical questions or whatever is the most insightful stuff, you know, share it with us. Spill it out. You don't have to, look, I'm not going to ask you to wrap it up this time. I'm going to ask you to put it in the next rep so we can get ready for the seller. But the seller and the club and the NAACP, we got some awards coming up now. We got to pace ourselves. But in the interim, what have been some of those pivotal questions or, you know, moments that you think would help listeners right now?
Well, I think when we talk about the fathers, in the beginning, the mothers are off and running. When they get that diagnosis, the mother want to know, okay, if they don't know, what is autism? The mothers want to know, what is autism? Then they want to know, what can I do, you know, to help my child? And they start joining support groups. And what I've seen in the past is that a lot of times the information is coming in so fast that the fathers are getting left behind because the mother is learning all this new information. She's trying to pass it on to the father. Sometimes they're interested. Sometimes they're not interested. But in the meantime, the mother is ongoing getting things put in place, and the father may feel left behind, isolated, like, well, I really don't matter. I'm not going to make a difference. And I want to just let fathers know and mothers know that fathers make a huge difference. It just sometimes it takes us longer to get on board because we don't want to maybe admit that our child is on the spectrum because we did have these hopes and dreams. It takes us a little bit longer to digest what we're going through because we haven't started talking about it. We haven't started verbalizing it to anyone. So when other fathers talk about it, I think it make it easier for more fathers to talk about it. And in law enforcement, the men and women in law enforcement, they're human beings. They make decisions every day on helping other people. Sometimes when you're in the position of helping other people, you know, you forget or you don't exactly know how to go about helping yourself. So that's what I want to do for the law enforcement community. Like, listen, we can help. We start by talking about it. We start figuring out resources that's available and strategies that you can do at home, because there's a lot that you can do at home to help lower the anxiety, help boost your child confidence, and to help your child to be a success and reach their full potential. Success and full potential looks different for every child. Every child, it looks different. So our thing is, how can we just take one thing at a time? How can we take one thing at a time, hopefully do well, and go on to the next thing? But it looks different for everyone. I want the people, I want individuals to know, embrace the journey, because you're going to learn so much more than about autism. You're going to learn so much more. You're going to learn to create those memories and those experiences, not only for yourself, but for your child. And this is what they're going to remember. So create those moments of joy, of miracles, and just don't stress out about it. And I know it's easier said than done, but take a step back and reflect on how far that you have come. Reflect on that you are still in this game, and you do have an opportunity to make a difference in your life and in your family life. You got this. You got this.
Right. Wow.
And it's
that's
okay to laugh, and they want a happy parent. It's okay to laugh, and kids want a happy parent.
You're right about dads. I think it's true in the end, just like, you know, two-parent households were created for a reason, you know, and there's repercussions for not having them. It's the same with, you know, with that, you know, with this. It shows up like it's a good point, you know, it makes sense. And I also just want to say to that, you know, as far as needing dads, and I also want to say to that, like, it will improve the mother's sense that she's not alone, that she's supported, which will defy all of the senses of, like, you know, being just completely in this by yourself. But for, on a dad's end, you know, I think that like, you know, if the dad doesn't have a community where he gets to talk about these things, it will breed depression. It will breed sense of isolation. It will breed, you know, all of those things, this loneliness, this sense of loss, you know, grief. And so I'm so glad that you're doing this, that you're doing this, because in the end, those children, it's usually with the mom that you're like, you know, dealing with academics or I don't know, right, all the technical stuff, social things, and this is how you greet a person. But with the dad, it's about the fun stuff. And even though the mom might be thinking, you know, let's get to work, you need that equal balance just for the reasons we just talked about as far as the benefits of exercise go. So this is great. With
Absolutely. And one other thing is that I noticed as well, I remember the first time that, you know, my wife went to a meeting, you know, with the school, and they were saying our son that he, you know, couldn't read, he didn't know his ABC. They were just saying all these things, and she was trying to explain to them exactly what was going on. Mind you, now this is about 17, 18 years ago, and then she asked me, you know, will you come to the next meeting? I go, absolutely. I have no issue. So we go and have the meeting, but, you know, by a man showing up sometime, and I've heard women say this, so it's not just coming from my perspective only. I heard women say this as well. By a man showing up to those meetings and participating, you notice a different tone when it comes from the academic field. You know, so my whole thing is, you know, fathers being involved, even just going to the meetings, even if they don't say anything or just ask one question, but just being present, they know that this child has people in his corners, and we're not going anywhere until we get the help that we need. And we're going to keep coming back until we get the resources that we need to help our child reach their full potential.
Yes. Wow. Mm-hmm. I could see that too. I don't know if it's a sense of, like, you know, this assumption, like, oh, single parent, you know what I'm saying? Like that attitude, you know, it's a woman, like, I don't know, like, versus when it's a man, you see, first of all, you see the man, you thinking, oh, well, you know, it's likely a woman behind him. So, okay, now two-parent household, that's already gone. That's what people's perspective, because it's like these people, you know, are educated. Like, I mean, it's just what it is, right? But then it's at this presence of a man. It's like, right, some level of respect or something. Like, so yeah, I mean, I think it's necessary.
And I'm just keeping it real, too, as a, you know, as someone who's taught, a lot of times the perception is that the mom is going to be more emotional about it, and the dad's going to be more, you know, logical.
Level-headed.
So the dad's easier to work with, and the mom complains too much, or whatever it may be. But
the mom
is going into the details, and the dad is looking at the overall picture, and sometimes that can be a challenge. So, but I do, as we're talking about perceptions and moms and dads and that kind of stuff, I did want to do this. I have It's a 2018 survey about autism awareness, and it talks about top 10 facts, not myths, facts about autism. And so I just wanted to read off the top 10, and you guys just give me your, you know, your feedback on feedback on it, whether how you feel about that particular quote. So number one says, excuse me, you are born with autism. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think that's actually, well, I guess maybe, I mean, I'm not going to say, I don't think anything's 100%, like, except for the Most High being real. And so I would say that it could be, but I don't think that that represents the majority. I think that this happens. And actually, I'm so glad you brought that up, because once we get through this, if we have time, I'm definitely going to want to come back to Mr. Brooks about the whole 18-month to 24-year, 24-month mark when he saw the change.
Well, my thing is, not being in the medical field, you know, that's a possibility. You could be born with it, but it hasn't been, you know, it hasn't been diagnosed at a particular time. I think that once you started reaching, going for these milestones, that's when they started noticing it. So it's like, were they born with it and you just haven't started reaching milestones, or does it develop later in life around 18 months and now you're able to notice it? So,
but you
know
what you said? See, I would be right there, and I'm sure there's probably cases where that it is clear cut. But in your case in particular, when you said that your child was, you know, had all these words, 20 plus words, and all of a sudden he started to like regress and down to two words, to me that's a sign that something changed, right? And so then I'm all about, you know, and that's why I said we need to definitely come back to this when we get through the 10 facts, because I actually, as an evaluator, as a clinical psychologist doing these gold standard assessments, had to ask these questions, you know, as far as what are you noticing that concerns you and your child? When did you first start noticing it? And when parents are saying the same thing to me at the 18 months, which is 1.5 year mark, or at the 24 months, which is 2 year mark, and then I say, well, what was going on around that time? You know, so I'm trying to make sense of it too. Like, right, something happened.
Right.
And
no,
then
exactly.
I learn a few stuff as far as vaccines, then it starts to make me wonder, you know. So we'll come back to that, and I'll tell you what CDC information, you know, is available to help make sense of what time.
And Dr. Valentin, these could be future conversations or something like that, you know, maybe when I want to call you Donnie McKirk, and I'm so sorry when Jerry makes that album, we can bring him back and he can make another rap about the next song. So question number two, or fact number two, it says you can't grow out of autism. What are your thoughts?
Yeah.
Well, actually,
I would say that's true because I think you can do with most things, I think you can overcome certain challenges where people may not notice that you're on the spectrum. But I look at my son right now, I think, who's doing very well, but you still see these little quirks in him.
Right.
But you don't know if that's part of autism or you don't know if it's just part of his personality, because we all have these little quirks. You know, we all, you know, maybe eat with our left hand, use our fork in our right or whatever, but we all have these little things. I don't think you can grow out of it, but I think you can overcome, you know, the symptoms of it.
Right, and I just laugh right now because my husband is a left, but he dribbles with his right hand, and I'm like, well, I get that. Like, he's dominant when it's right hand on the basketball court. I'm like, well, I can get that if you were taught by a righty, you know. But then it's like, why are you eating with your right hand? Like, I'm like, man, you're a fraud. Like, I'll mess with him, so that's why I was laughing. You're a fraud. Like, be lefty. Like, come on. Like, but it's
that's
something
right.
Because
give him an evaluation.
Right, and I'm just saying I do agree. I know I first said like lies, but actually I agree. What the reason why I said lies to start with is because oftentimes medical providers would justify their misdiagnosis by saying, oh, the person just grew out of it, whether they're saying autism, ADHD, and that to me is not possible. If that's what you have, like, this is a neuropsychological disorder. This isn't like, you know, anxiety that you come across some traumatic experience. And so you're right, you know, I'm with Mr. Brooks that you can learn ways to manage it so that it's not impacting your life negatively or the way it has been. It's one of those things that if you stop using those interventions, you'll see the regression, or you'll see the stuff, you know, the symptoms show up. So I think that if a person no longer has it, which is the case in 50% of adults with ADHD, which is another neuropsychological disorder, because, you know, we got autism, ADHD, learning disorders, and intellectual disability that falls in that under that umbrella term of neuropsychological disorders. To me, that means that the person never had it to begin with. They were misdiagnosed.
And that's why I worked at Duke Center for Autism and Brain Development for a little while, and there were people losing their diagnosis. But one of the things that was discussed was that they were probably misdiagnosed in the beginning. It was a research clinic, but, you know. Okay, number three, autistic people are better at some things. Do you agree or disagree?
Oh, agree.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. I used to play Jenga with this kid that had autism, and man, oh, man, he would just pull everything out, and I'm like, how did you – because we knew it was going to fall. He was driving crazy. Number five, there are more people with autism than we know. What do you think? More or less meaning there are undiagnosed people. What do you think?
Probably there probably are, but like I said, I'm not in the. I haven't done any surveys on it, but just in generally speaking, I would think so. I would think so.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's what I was kind of getting at early when I'm saying, you know, if it's a person that may be like, you know, high, you know, functioning autism, what they would have called Asperger's, would say, you know, they took it away and now they just say autism spectrum. You know, maybe, but it just. You kind of still notice, like, if they meet the criteria, you notice something. Other than that, if it's full on what I was talking about earlier, you know, full on sort of symptom, I don't think it's possible to get through life without people knowing, you know, even if they can't put their finger on it exactly, but people will know.
But one of the things that I notice also is that if a person if they haven't been exposed to it, I know that we're talking about it, we've heard about it, doctor, you're in the field, so you definitely know about it. But even with my friends, they tell me, they go, I've never heard of autism until you started talking about it. Now I hear about it all the time.
Mm. It makes you wonder it makes me think of a car, you know, how like I never knew of a grandson, I start seeing it all over the place, you know. So it's like, no, people were talking about it. You just weren't hearing it, you know.
For sure.
One of the things that I kept hearing was that because some people go to a general practitioner maybe once a year, you know, for the once a year physical, what happens is they could have a trait or a symptom, but when they get to the doctor, they say, oh, no, this is just this week. It's not. You know, it's not on the continuum. So what happens is certain traits are missed because people are going to see different doctors. Like, you know, like if you go to a like a general practitioner where there's like five or seven doctors and you don't see the same doctor all the time.
Correct.
So because you're not seeing the same doctor, you can't really see a pattern, huh?
I was going to say, to me, I would think of it. I see exactly what you're saying. So I'm certain that happens, you know. But the way I think more is like, if you're seeing the same person, it's more likely that they'll miss it versus if you're seeing a different person, you got new eyes on you. And so they may catch it more. They may catch what somebody else, you know, missed because of a 15-minute visit. But it's like you have more chances of somebody catching it because this person may know more than that other person. They might have, you know, this specialty or this, you know, greater experience in it.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry, doctor.
I'm just thinking, like, if a doc is following you, sometimes, see, what I hear is, because, you know, I worked in these settings with the medical providers, right? And oftentimes, you know, they'll follow a client from birth to, I don't know, 7 or something, and it'll be the client that has to say to the doc, hey, you know, the teacher is concerned about this. The teacher's noticing this, or my cousin has this, and I see some of those same symptoms. You know, and so it's like they have to tell the doc. And I know part of it, maybe this is the moderator, the sort of factor that would make sense of my piece and your piece, Kelly, Coach KJ, is you know, that these 15-minute visits aren't cutting it. So maybe if it was a 30-minute visit, then it would be more of what you're saying. But in my experience, I'm coming from places where the practitioners have, the providers have 15-minute visits, not me, but I'm talking medical. And so if they have less opportunity to catch stuff and they might minimize something because they would have thought that they would have caught it 2 years ago, you know?
And that's, Doctor, that's exactly what I was going to touch on, but you hit the nail on the head. These 15-minute visits, that's why we encourage parents to keep a journal when you go into the doctor, because there's a lot to remember. So when you keep a journal, you can go into the doctor and you can highlight exactly what you're seeing, what's going on with your child, because 15 minutes is nothing. The doctor's got things to get on to the next patient, and maybe their mind somewhere else. And also the doctors are a human being as well. They got home issues. They got work issues going on. So I just think in the short amount of time, you got to be as specific as possible.
And
so
I was reading somewhere
that
general practitioners have like 2,500 patients on their caseload. It's like something crazy. The average general practitioner, it's a really, really high number. I'll put the number in the notes. And it said that a doctor, in order to fully cure and chronic diagnosis, like those types of three different preventative, chronic, and the other thing is, they were saying that a doctor should spend 21.7 hours a day in the office. In order to properly diagnose the client, the patient load that they have, because 15 minutes is not long enough. So what they were
the institution that they work for increase their visits to 30 minutes minimum, and then, which would decrease then the number of time they should spend in the office. You know what I'm saying? Or you know what I'm saying? Because I think that's part of why on the other end we have more diagnoses it makes me wonder, is it really this many children with these disorders, is it that they're letting the patient do their job, or really the teacher, by saying, hey, doc, the teacher is complaining about this. Can you assess for that? And then you do a real quick rating scale or measure that focuses just on that thing. And so, of course, you're going to get a hit. Mr. Brooks just talked about some overlap across, you know, right? Sensory issues in autism, anxiety in autism, oppositional. So look, if you just walk in and say the teacher says he thinks he has oppositional defiant disorder, and that doc sees that tantrum, she's gonna be like, yep, she's gonna focus her assessment because she got 15 minutes, or he has 15. See, so I think it works the other end too. You know, because it just makes me wonder: do we also really have this many children with these disorders? And if we do, then we really need to wonder why, because oftentimes you'll hear the industry pat themselves on the back and say that it's because, sort of access to care or all the stuff that sounds good, you know, accessibility. But I don't know that it's that, because, again, 50% of individuals, and I'm just saying ADHD because that's the stat that I have in my head with the 50% that turn into adults, you know, make it to adulthood, that do not lose their diagnosis, like, admit that they was misdiagnosed, you know. So
Dr. Valentino, if parents are coming to you, so if we were to go back in time, if I could turn back time, hey, Karen, we might do a duet. Wait a second. If I were to turn back time, if we were to turn back time and Carrie were to come to your office, Dr. Valentino, what would you tell him to bring with him to make sure that his son got the proper diagnosis? Now, I know that you're completely different than other physician, but what would you tell him, or what would you tell our listeners to make sure that they're bringing them, you know, mm-hmm. to get the best, most comprehensive diagnosis? And what should they be asking for? What should they be demanding?
Excellent question. And look at this very easy answer. I would ask the parent to come in, preferably with both parents, because sometimes it is single parents, and so you'll get the report of one parent and not the other, and it's so vital to hear from both, because sometimes one might not remember birth history like the other, or might not see the child, you know what I'm saying, during the day, because they're the ones working, like how he was describing his wife spent time with the babe while he was at work. So I would prefer both parents, or at least primary caregiver and like a secondary caregiver, like a grandparent. And then the child, that's it. That's all I need. I need the child, who is the person in question, right? And I need the caregiver. That's it. I have everything else, right? I have the gold standard testing. I have the experience, the education. So it's really, I'm the expert on this issue, you know, like the symptoms and how to get to the bottom of does these symptoms belong to this disorder or that one, because as you all know, there's a bunch of overlap across childhood disorders, right? And then you're the expert on your child. You're the one spending that time with that child. You just don't know, you know, exactly what these symptoms might be better explained by. So that's all I would need. That's
what about
it. And then,
what about pictures or videos of certain things, of how they do things?
It would be, it's not necessary. If the parent has it, absolutely, you know, absolutely take it. I would think that I'm not going to tell a parent, you know, in preparation when we go through like the, you know, consultation, the free consultation, and then like, you know, we schedule the appointment. We're not going to say, okay, between now and when I see you in a week or in a month or, you know, whatever, make sure you take as much video footage. No, it's going to be, if you already taking video footage, clearly it's because you like, somebody got to see this. You know, but otherwise you're just describing it to me. And I know exactly, I'm asking the questions that are hallmark to every, to all of the symptoms across each of the childhood disorders. So I'm not just going to focus. You're not going to tell me that you think your child has autism. I mean, or you know what I'm saying? That's it. And I'm just going to just focus on autism, right? Because I know that there's overlap across the different childhood disorders. So I'm going to examine autism, but I'm also going to examine ADHD. I'm going to examine sensory processing disorder. I'm going to, you know, because I, you know, I'm going to look at anxiety, you know, I'm going to ask like if there is any kind of like trauma that occurred. Is this occurring in the school setting and not the home setting? Or is it occurring in the home setting and not the school setting, right? Some of these disorders used to occur in both, while others can just occur, like anxiety can just occur at school but not at home, you know? Or you see what I'm saying? So, in the end, you've been dealing with the situation. All you have to do is come with that child in your memory, and I'll handle the rest.
What are you thinking, Carrie?
I'm thinking she's hitting the nail on the head, and I would just encourage, you know, the parents when they come in, because it's a crisis that you're going through at that particular time, but to come in and just tell your story as specific as possible. And to ask the doctor, have you seen this in the past? If you've seen this in the past, you know, now I'm starting to build up my network. Are there any groups that I can join? What resources do you know of that you can put me in touch with? Because when you're going through this crisis, parents want to know, what can I do? And I just think a lot of times the doctors are go, we got the diagnosis, but a lot of times, you know, they go, well, you know, I've heard of this, I've heard of that. Like, no, you have anything more specific? And the school is also a very good place to start when you start looking for what can I do. You got the individualized education plan at school, whether everyone that's responsible for your child education are going to be involved, and that's where your child going to be spending most of the time for the next 18 years is in school.
Right.
So it's like that. That's a great place to start as well when you want to get some of these questions answered regarding resources.
Yeah.
The doctor explained it very well.
Keep going, guys.
I was just going to say that he's right, that your child isn't spending just their time at home. They're spending it, you know, really probably majority of the time, at least, you know, waking time, at least majority of it at school. And so it's true that whole saying, it takes a village to raise a child, like the school is a part of your village. And if without special education accommodations in the form of a 504 plan, which is supported under the 504 Act, or an individualized education plan, IEP, you know, without that, basically, you're going to be dealing with the teacher just complaining to you daily versus now this holds the teacher accountable. This, because now the teacher knows what is going on and how to approach your child. You know, it's very specific. It's not just in, you know, like what does the child need for math or for English or reading, but also like, you know, is there a communication device that's necessary? You know, does the child get to have movement breaks? Can the child actually have a bottle of water in class, go to the bathroom like multiple times? You know what I'm saying? Like all types of, I mean, extra time to complete work, like, you know, smaller classroom settings so that there's little stimulation, maybe headphones, like I think I mentioned earlier. I mean, there's so much stuff. And sometimes accommodations in the school setting could translate to the home setting, not only because they're communicating like strategies that they're using that you could also use at home, but because they might give you the same communication device they have at school for you to take home. Like they could connect you, and if not the medical provider, to different state sort of, you know, resources that you are eligible for, you know, to help basically improve the quality of life for your child, the success, you know, of your child.
The thing I like about the IEP is that it's all documented. So if they're gonna lay out specific goals that they want your child to reach and what they're doing to reach those goals, and everyone who's involved with your child education, they're part of those meetings, the counselor, the teachers, the parents. So they're involved. So everyone is on board with helping your child to become successful. That's a lot of time you would meet parents and they would go, you know, my child doesn't need any help. I'm like, if the help is there, take it.
Right.
If the resource is there, use it. There's no stigma in using resources that's going to help your child to become successful. You know, even with our child, we wanted him to be in a mainstream class. So what they would do is where he needed extra help, they would pull him out, go to a smaller classroom where maybe two or three kids are being involved, and then he'll go back to the larger class. Where does he sit in the larger class? Because you know what? He doesn't like people sitting too close to him. He starts to get a little bit of anxiety if people too close. You know, it's the boy or the girl right to him or the left of him. Are they talking too much? Are they too fidgety? So where do we sit this child in the class where they can be successful? Do they have a problem with vision? Are they sitting close up? Are they sitting in the back of the classroom? So, but you've got multiple people evaluating this. It's not just you. It's a huge, tremendous help.
It's true. I'm even thinking about the speech therapist that'll be involved, you know, because if we're talking about social communication disorder, it's not just that your child may be delayed, you know, language-wise, but it could be that they're speaking on par with it, like they have the words maybe at that grade level, but they don't understand social talk, like sarcasm, jokes, and so they, you know, the speech therapist could help with that too, and that would be in a school. But I always, of course, encourage my parents not to just rely on the school system, because what if you get a thing like COVID where the school is, you know, shut down and they virtual. Like some students still got accommodations during it, but a lot of my clients wasn't until I stepped in. It's also the case that if your child, like in Chicago, they went on strike a couple times, you know, and so when there's a strike, there's no class. So it's like your child should be getting, you know, these therapies outside of the school, because also you got winter break, which is 3 weeks, and you got summer break, which is, what, 2 months. So plus, I figure, why not? While this child is yet a sponge, young, you know, and receptive, why not give them the speech therapy? And if they need occupational therapy, which is what covers, you know, or addresses sensory-related concerns, it's like, he's right, like you got all of these different people involved. So it is definitely worth it, because to take on the approach that, like, it's going to be stigmatizing, or to have to accept that there is an issue, is really to the parents' demise. Like, it's, I mean, and maybe maybe they just need a little bit of time to experience the child regressing or struggling to then finally accept the help. But one thing I want to tell the listeners is, you know, when you're finally ready to, like, get your child this help, like, all you got to do is either go, you know, online and figure out, like, just type in, how do I write a letter, you know, a sample letter petitioning the school for accommodations.
And you could do that. It has to be in writing. You can't just say to the teacher, I need help, or I want my child evaluated, because it's not enough, unfortunately. At least in Chicago it isn't. Maybe some schools in the suburbs out here, and maybe where y'all are in a different state. But, you know, if you try that, it don't work, definitely go written. You know, some people will get that letter from the medical provider, and so that also is an option, but sometimes they need, you know, the schools give you a hard time where they need you to do some testing in order to, you know, prove that your child has an issue. So that's when you just call the Board of Education and say that they're, you know, keeping services from my child. But generally speaking, I think a letter will suffice. My point, what I wanted to get to is that if a parent is concerned about the stigma, you can start your child on interventions and then decide to take them off of it the next year. It's not like it just stays with them. It's not like it follows them. Some people worry it's going to follow them to college. It's going to mess with their opportunity to get into high school. No, it's like, no,
exactly.
No. It doesn't. Like, it actually benefits you. It actually benefits them, not only academically and socially, but some schools, like they'll help you point-wise on big standardized tests. Because you had this, I mean, think about it in terms of, and this is an analogy I tend to use a lot in my sessions with clients, is, you know, think about if your child, you know, like had one leg or something, whether it was an accident or whatever, like, you know, they had one leg to work with. I mean, how ridiculous would it be to expect them to just hop around, you know, class? Like, wouldn't you want them to have crutches or a wheelchair? Or maybe a prosthetic leg? Wouldn't you want them to have access to the elevator, or at least be able to leave classes a little early so that they aren't constantly late to every class? Like, that's embarrassing. It actually is more stigmatizing to then be now the late guy every time. You know, it's like the same thing with a child who can't see or hear. Like, it wouldn't be right to give them the same, if they couldn't see, you know, to give them the same book as the other students, or to write on the board. Like, if they're smart, they're still going to maybe get a passing grade like a C. But if they're A quality, that's just, like, rude, I consider it, you know, to make the child go through that. And that's why, in part, they be feeling depressed and anxious and down, because they notice. You know, that there is a difference. Like, they know that they're dysregulated, or they're marginalized or ostracized, you know. So hope that helps.
I just wanted to ask one question. When parents are doing this, or when people are looking for something, looking for assistance, how long should they go? Let's say that they're doing it and it's regressing and the kids are not making progress, or mm-hmm. they're going, you know, reverse in a particular area. How long should a parent wait before they change, abort, or whatever it may be? What would you say was the standard?
You asking me, or do you want to?
I'm asking you, Dr. Valentino, what do you recommend? Like, how long do you say, okay, you know what, this kid is not making the progress that was expected, huh?
Mm-hmm. Right, like progressing with the interventions or accommodations. I would definitely want to examine why that is. Like, I'd be asking, if we believe that these interventions would be successful for a person who's going through, you know what I'm saying, like certain kind of issues, it's not a one size fits all, but it's kind of clearly like, hey, you like speech therapy would help with like better understanding jokes or sarcasm, or right, if I just stick with that example and the child's not getting it, I would be wondering about the speech therapist. I wouldn't be thinking about the child necessarily, you know what I'm saying? The child necessarily, except that the child isn't progressing, you know? So I'd be looking at the intervener, you know, or the system. I'd be wondering like why, like what's who, you know, yeah, that's why I would not encourage the parent to abort services. You know, it would just be more like, maybe we need to switch the therapist, or maybe we need to have the therapist try some different interventions, but not just all together stop the therapy or stop the tutoring, or you know what I mean?
Just to add on to that
from a parent perspective, I would definitely, you know, encourage the parents to trust their instinct, because every doctor is not for every family, and you got to be able to trust. You got to be able to trust the doctor and to build that relationship. And if you feel that you're not being heard, whether it's true or not true, and building up trust, I don't think the attention or the advice they're given is going to be well received. So I would ask the parents to trust their instincts, to be open to the medical profession. But if they feel that they're not being heard, they're not being listened to, or just not going well, you know, trust your instinct. It may be time to find someone else who provides services, but they got a better way of connecting and communicating with you.
Yes, yes, I agree. When you said that, it also made me think about, like, psychotropic drugs. Like, oftentimes this is part of why parents don't want to go in and see the medical provider. It's not just the – it's not really as much the label as it is the intervention or treatment that's going to come consequence of the label. And oftentimes, you know, the parents are thinking, man, they're going to give my child a prescription drug, which I'm trying to avoid. And so even now, like, there's nothing – like there's nothing clear cut for autism, but they're working on it, and they're definitely giving guanfacine and all types of like antipsychotics and things like that to treat like the behaviors. When it's like, this is crazy. Why don't you just get them in therapies? Like, that's, they need to learn how to manage this stuff and figure out where it's even come. Like, what's the triggers, or what are the, you know, the triggers. Like, you know, so I could definitely see a parent like, you know, like not being heard because they're saying, no, I don't want to take that approach, but it's sort of being encouraged strongly, you know. So it's like, no, leave that situation because the person's not hearing you.
Yeah.
Wow. So with all the things that, because we're at 11:36, and I'm just being cognizant of, you know, being aware of the time.
Okay.
If there was something.
I'm sorry, I'm central, so that's why I'm like 10:36. But right, in the end, we only got like 23 minutes.
And you know, we always get cut off because, not that I talk a lot, but, you know.
So silly.
I'm so shy. I'm trying to do it. Dr. Valentina, you helped me get over my shyness. Thank you. I don't know what I'd do without you. Thank you for helping me. If we could possibly go back to the 18 to 20 month question.
Thank
that you,
yes.
Because I want to make sure that we don't, you know, go over time.
Thank you so much, because I didn't want to, you know, brush over whatever it is that you have planned, because I'm telling you, Coach KJ be on it. Like, she's the one that basically structures this whole, like, 2 hours, and it be packed with excellent stuff. So, you know, but it's like, you know, and so I hadn't planned to bring this up. But when you brought that up, Mr. Brooks, I'm like, oh, man, we just got to go there. You know, we got to go there. Because seriously, this is the experience of, I want to say, like 95%. I really want to say 100% of those who I've met, but it's probably been more like 95%. So I'll just start off by saying very quickly that when I was on fellowship, I remember, like, it was even before fellowship that I was trained in the administration of, like, the ADOS-2, which is that gold standard assessment used, you know, to assess the child, and then also the ABIR, which is the parent interview. So those two things together, what you do with the child, what you do with the parent, is what's needed ultimately to determine if the child has a diagnosis. But I, on fellowship, actually worked in a team setting with, like, developmental pediatricians, neuropsychologists, occupational therapists, and speech pathologists when it came to assessing children with autism. And I always, it was five, you know, I was a part of the 5 to 18 year old group, like, you know, helping those clients. And so, it's interesting because every time I would ask, like, you know, nearly every time I would ask, like, you know, what's going on and when you first started seeing it, parents would say, like, you know, this parent would say like 18-month mark, this other parent would say 24 mark, and it just kind of went like that. And I was on fellowship. This is what you go on after you get your doctorate degree. But you know, basically it's before you can get licensed to practice independently as a clinical psychologist. You know, you had to get these postdoc supervision hours under a licensed clinical psychologist before you could even sit to take the exam. So I was, you know, being supervised for the first couple months that I was there before then, me being able to do it all on my own. And I remember the client saying that to him and then saying that to me when I would take over the interviews, and him being there now shadowing me, and he would, like, it would bother him, my supervisor, because he knew that that was shaping how I was now thinking of autism, because it's too many people that's basically saying this is when they're starting to see symptoms. There's no issue with my child, right? My child is smiling on greeting as a newborn. My, right? My child is, you know what I'm saying, responding to his name. My child is crawling on time. My child is responding to patty cake, peekaboo. Like, come on, social stuff, right? And then all of a sudden, my child is walking. My child is talking, you know, and all of a sudden, when they hit the 1.5 year mark at 18 months old, 2 year mark at 24 months old, there's a change. There's a shift. Something happened. And then it's like, okay, I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, well, what happened? Like, what? Because they're coming to me trying to figure out not just what does my child have, but why do they have it? And I can never say the why, but I'm like, I'm thinking, you know more than I do because you're the one with this child, right? So you tell me, what have you noticed? And in asking those questions, they all, it's so tripped out, majority, not all, would say, you know, this is when my child got his, you know, 1.5 year vaccines or 2 year vaccines. And what's interesting is it got to the point where my supervisor even gave me, like, first of all, he would get upset with patients, which was unprofessional, and say, there is no link. There is no research that is demonstrating the link to autism and vaccines. But just because the research ain't out there don't mean, you know what I'm saying, that it's not true. I mean, usually in practice, we discover stuff in our practices that then cause us to research it, right, cause us to examine it. And, you know, even when it comes to interventions, we trying out stuff all the time with clients, right, before we then say, clients are responding well to this. Let's research it and see if we could, like, replicate this finding across different clients to say, okay, this is a true and effective treatment. And so it works the opposite way as well, you know, and so it's interesting because I would then go to my husband and be like, this is interesting. Like, this is what I'm discovering. This is, like, nuts. This is how my supervisor responded to the clients. This is what he said to me then in supervision, trying to show me articles. The articles saying that, that they've been trying to see if there is a link, which means other psychologists or medical providers across the nation had also been hearing something similar. You see what I'm saying? That's sort of what that's confirmation of, is that other people also, if they're writing on this, you know, this very issue, it means that it up too has been brought to light, you know, from client interactions, that there's a concern that when people are getting these vaccines, there's this reaction, there's this consequence to this toxin that's being put in their body. And so, anyways, I shared this with my husband, and who I was just kind of sharing, like, this is what happened today, right, at fellowship. But he was taking a mental note because it was, I guess I was saying it so much. And when we was then, you know, planning to have our first baby, he was like, we ain't getting no vaccines until we do our research. You know what I'm saying? Because it's almost like you got to take heed. Like, it's a blessing to almost have this information so that you could kind of learn from it or figure it out. And so we did not vaccinate our children. And before, literally, because of what I learned from my own clients, and also because when I did research on this stuff, so I first went to, of course, the Trusted CDC website, because that's, like, where you go for a lot of this stuff. And do you all know that there's information that you could find right now? I looked this stuff up years ago, because my oldest is 5 years old and my youngest is 3. And actually, we didn't even completely look it up for the 5-year-old. We was just like, we ain't got time to look it up, so we just going to be safe and sorry, and we not going to get the stuff. But for our 3-year-old, we was back in Chicago, because I was in Wisconsin at first, so I could handle them people. But in Chicago, I'm dealing with my own people, right? Because Wisconsin was, like, rural, and it was like, you know, I was just strong out there. But Chicago, it's like I'm dealing with my own people as far as color, as far as, you know, age and hipness and all of that. So I'm like, I need to be ready for them. So I look, I do my research, and I'm just like, oh, wow. I go to the CDC's website, and it tells you in 1950, there was 13 vaccines that was given to children between birth, which they say 0 years old, to 6 years old, right, 13. In 1980-something, let's say 80, let's just say 1980s, that number went down to 10. And that was because the MMR was combined. So measles, mumps, rubella was combined, right? And so it went from 13 to 10 vaccines that's given to children between ages 0 to 6 years old. And then in 2010, it went up to 36. 36 vaccines that's given to children between the ages of 0 to 6 years old. And then I looked even closer because you can hone in on the CDC's information. And it tells you that between 0 and 2 years old, you get like – you get 20-something of those shots. So in the end, you know, I think it's like 24 of the 36 shots. You see what I'm saying? So it's like it makes you wonder, you know, then about the ingredients that's in these vaccines. And that also is something that you could find when you go to Johns Hopkins website. And it's stuff that is very terrible. You got it was mercury, and then the parents protested that. And that ingredient was taken out, but it was replaced with aluminum, which is just as toxic on the brain. And if you all recall, I've used the term neuropsychological disorder to explain the, you know, the neuropsychological disorders, which would be autism spectrum disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, better known as ADHD, learning disorders, whether reading, math, writing, and intellectual disability. So I encourage people. I don't tell people, you know, nothing the way I don't want to be pegged as any other, you know, provider. Instead, what I say is, you know, I'm saying it's out here now. Just look the stuff up. It's available readily. It's not readily shared, but it's readily accessible. CDC's website, Johns Hopkins website, you know. So I just want to just let you know that I want to say that because otherwise, just like you was talking, Mr. Brooks, about, you know, dads feeling alone and oftentimes, you know, that breeding sort of symptoms of depression, symptoms of grief and loss of what they wish their child, and KJ, you talked about this, what their child, what they expected their child to be, you know, it just, it's the same with this. Sometimes parents blame themselves. What did I do? You know, what did I eat? Where did I go? Who did I marry, right? Who did I sleep with? Is this a part of his family history? Because that is also one of the main questions you get, right, is, you know, is there other children in your family with autism spectrum disorder? Because that'll be a good way to be like, okay, then the occurrences, you know, your chances are higher, right? But yeah, it's more like maybe it's that in your family you all respond, you know, this way to this toxin or this ingredient. You know what I'm saying?
Dr. Valentina, I just wanted to throw out one thing. I did a little bit of work. You know, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a doctor. I'm just a singer. No, I'm just kidding. but one of the things that we don't really address a lot of times is the Ig level, and that's your immune system. And yes, there's Iga, yes. Ige, Igg, Igm, and Igd, which they have, like, you know, not necessarily done a lot of research on. But Iga is something that kids are born with, and I can't remember the percentage. I have it in a document. I just did a document for NAACP. I think it's 50% of kids are not born with this IgA immune system, right? And so basically, because you're not born with this, this is the thing that protects, like, the mucus lining, the respiratory system, you know, gastrointestinal areas, and those are the areas that kids with autism seem to be highly impacted by. So people who are missing this IgA, immunoglobulin A, it seems to impact, like, sinus infections, lung infections, digestive system, celiac disease, allergies, lupus, all these different things, once again, that are tied in with autism. And I wonder if, and I don't know if it's a vaccine, it could be, you know, somebody could be allergic to smoke, you know, so because you're not able to handle the, you know, the toxins in the air that could impact your system. I wonder if that could play a role in whether or not you're able to build up your immune system to handle the different things that are going on around you. And you know, when your immune system is weak, it also impacts your central nervous system. And then you've got the amygdala that's impacted, right? You know, your fear, flight, all those different things are impacted. So I don't know if there's been any studies to look at IgA levels, but I think that that is also key, because if kids don't have the initial, you know, if they don't have the initial system to fight off the things that are coming in, then, you know,
Then they're vulnerable, and it makes you wonder, like, because in the end, a lot of children with autism also have, you know, allergies and asthmas, you know, and so, you know, and by the way, there's a great book. I need to look it up. I'll make sure I have it in the next like 5 minutes, but there's two docs, who are like, I want to say psychiatrists, but they don't, or maybe one's a psychiatrist and one's also a medical doc, which is what a psychiatrist would be, but it, you know, it isn't a psychiatrist. And they both have healthy, like natural ways to deal with, you know what I'm saying, autism, to the point where one will say the symptoms won't even look anymore like autism, because they'll say that really it's the all of this stuff is toxins, whether it's something you put in your body sort of purposefully but unknowing that it's toxins in the vaccines, through vaccines, or like the stuff in the air. But he basically talks about how you know, there you can fight that off with sort of natural medicines, with you know, copper, and I think he says like copper excess hurts the body and makes you look like you have ADHD, just like how lead excess does. So if you take zinc to help sort of level the stuff off, that could then help reduce symptoms like inattention, hyperactivity, aggressiveness. And so they got all types of stuff, even for autism. Like, it's amazing. I bought the book. So I'll look this stuff up as you all talk, to make sure that we share that resource with parents.
Yeah, and I'll say this. I promise quickly. I have a couple classmates in New Jersey who did this, and I also work with a doctor at Duke, and but she was from another hospital, and she had a son with quote-unquote severe autism. And what she did for that son was she gave him plasma exchange IVIG. And the son who was severe autism, you know, disruptive behaviors, et cetera, is now a UNC Chapel Hill graduate. And so that was addressing the IVIG, addressed the Ig levels, the immunoglobulin levels. And a lot of times we don't look into, the clinical name is, I think, hypogammaglobulinemia, something along those lines. But a lot of times we don't look into, once again, the ability to ward off, you know, things that may impact, once again, our central nervous system, which ultimately impacts, of course, our fear, flight, and social behaviors. And a lot of times, and I could be wrong, with autism, it seems as though people resort to social behaviors as a key indicator of whether or not someone has a, you know, has autism.
Right, exactly. Look at the symptoms as opposed to the sort of cause or root, you know. And I found the resource. So it's Dr. Kenneth Bach, B-O-C-H, and his book is called Healing the Childhood Epidemic. And then he has the four A's, speaking of autism, asthma, ADHD, and allergies. So Dr. Bach, B-O-C-H, Healing the Childhood Epidemic, the four A's, so it's like hyphen the four A's. And then there's also Dr. James Greenblatt. He's the psychiatrist who treats ADHD naturally. I think he also has stuff in his book, too, about treating autism. Like, he'll say stuff about, you know, certain foods that, you know, just don't do well in the gut, and so naturally then bring about, you know, uncomfortable feelings that then result in symptoms like, you know, the tantrums and stuff like that. Because even when you think about sensory processing, it's like, okay, this sort of what is going on that is causing that dysregulation, and is there, you know, just like – we could put stuff in our bodies consciously or unconsciously, or be exposed to stuff, like you said, in the air, that'll make us vulnerable to these things, and it could hurt us. It's the same way we can heal our bodies, because the body is really, it's really incredible. It was made perfectly. You know, so yeah, but this kind of stuff isn't advertised, so sometimes it can be hard to, like, accept that there is a way, like, you know, it's like we don't want to psych ourselves out and then be all, like, disappointed, but really we gotta kind of let go of the sort of American attitude of, like, helplessness and try, you know,
there are options, like I said, you know, yeah. Food, immune system, exercise, it just all yeah. depends on what your body needs, and you know, there's a team mm-hmm. of people that can work with you. Carrie, I wanted to catch you, what are your thoughts on once again, anything that can possibly assist people? I wanted to touch on to it, but, well, you know what? Give me a few seconds. Can you just tell me a little bit about your son going to college? Like, what happened beforehand and you got him in?
Well, basically, he really got himself in. We stuck with our program of trying to do our best to help him reach his full potential. But he ended up graduating. He was going to school in Ecuador. I was in Ecuador at the time. He graduated high school in Ecuador with honors. And he applied for one college, and we got a package in the mail. We got a call, actually, from the school, like, hey, did you receive your package? Go, what package? The acceptance letter for college. Like, when did he apply? Yeah. So it looked like he applied looked like he applied online, you know, at night. So,
wow.
Like, we called his name. Like, hey, did you apply to college? Go, yeah, nonchalantly, yes. And it's like,
wow.
Why didn't you tell us? But he just never saw this, like, as an emotional type of thing. It's like, hey, I'm going to do it, and I did it. I got to accept it. So during the pandemic, he withdrew from college, got a job, and now he's in another college starting this coming January. But now he's working, and he's going to work and go to school at the same time. So for me, because he wasn't getting the full college experience, but he made the decision on his own for him to go, hey, I'm not getting the full experience. I can do self-study if I wanted to and have the same benefit. That's what I wanted for him. I don't want to tell him what to think. I want to teach him how to think, and he's doing it. That's what I wanted for him. Yeah.
Wow. When he was in Ecuador, where were you?
I was in Ecuador as well. I was working in Ecuador.
That is cool.
So does he live at home?
Not now. Now he's in Arizona with relatives, and he's working in Arizona. He's going to go to school in Arizona. Right now I'm in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
Well, you're in Saudi
Arabia
right now?
Correct. Yes.
Wait, what time is it out
here? What is the temperature?
The weather's doing much better now. It's a little bit cooler because we're going into the fall season, and the time is 7:58.
Is that
morning.
A.m.?
Oh, yeah,
wow.
A.m.
Wow.
Thank you so much.
Of course. You invited me. Thank you for the invitation. I showed up, so thank you.
Incredible.
Thank you. Carrie, how can people reach you? If they want more insight from you, support, how can they reach you? We have less than 90 seconds.
They can send me an email at support@autismtoawesome.com. They can visit the website, www.autismtoawesome.com, and follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter. I'm the same monarchy, Autism to Awesome.
And what are the things that you have available right now, Carrie? I know that you have the book.
Say that again. I didn't hear your question.
Please tell me the things that you have available right now that people can access.
We have the book, we have one-on-one coaching, and also we're starting our online courses as well. But our thing is the book and doing one-on-one coaching, which can be done virtually. Doesn't matter where I am or where they are. We help them to put together strategies, how to identify resources, what they can do at home to help their child reach their full potential, and to help the family allow their greatest crisis to become their greatest miracle by rethinking, reimagining, and reconditioning the misconception of autism.
Yes.
And tell me once again, how can they contact you one more time?
Support at autism2awesome.com. They can send me an email, or they can go to our website and they can send an email through there, or they can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and contact us through the social media as well.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Carrie, thank you so much for everything. Dr. B, phenomenal as always. I just want to also mention that our song going out was written by, our beat was written by Marcus Boyce, who is also a person, a thriver with autism. So thank you so much for everything, guys. And the music is
Thank you, ladies.
You are welcome.
Thank you so much.
I'll be sending you an email too. Dr. Brooks. Looking for it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
He's a musical
Have a good
doctor.
Morning. Right. All right. Have a good morning, Mr. Brooks.
You have a good evening.
Have a good night, ladies.
Thank you, everybody. Thank
you.
Bye-bye. Dr. Valentino, I forgot to say, thank you so much for the compliment. And you, too, are phenomenal. We are great together. Thanks so much.